writer Colin Fleming, one of our favorites, joining us today. And we're going to talk about Brackets, If You, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope, his latest collection of short stories, a brilliant collection of short stories. We're going to talk about a lot of aspects of what makes this a collection great. So, Colin, are you here with us?
I am. How you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing well, sir. This is a pleasure. I'm looking forward to this a lot. This morning I was looking back through some of the many great stories. I think Yellowhammers might be my favorite, but there are a lot of really good ones. But I was thinking about a line here. There's a difference between a harbor and a sea, which appears in one of the stories, and we'll talk about it in a minute. It seems to me there's a difference between a collection of great short fiction and today's anthology of the same story told 12 times. You have done something I just don't see. You've got a book where all the stories are great, and they don't need any of the others to rely on to make them great. I'm sure you did that on purpose.
Yeah, I did. Well, it came together that way on purpose. That wasn't the original intent, but it's like we have to call these things, even when they're in book form, stories. It's just like the handy catch-all, and I do that just for convenience's sake. But I don't, once they join up together for the greater purpose of the book, I don't really think, and I think if people read this book, I don't think you can really classify it as a collection. Because a collection is like a compilation, to put it in music terms. And it's not just Sgt. Pepper. It's going to cherry pick through the years. It's going to be the red album, the blue album, to use the Beatles analogy. So I don't like books like that. And books like that by other people are born out of their necessity, because that's just simply what they're going to have. It's going to be, okay, here I was in this program, or I was in this workshop, or I was at this artist colony, or whatever, after all. And these are the 8 to 10 things I managed to write in the last 11 years that I workshopped to death with people who are doing the exact same thing and writing the exact same way. And the only reason, the only justification, quotes around it, for them to be together is they were by me and they were what I could manage. But that doesn't make it a book.
No.
And it certainly doesn't make it a work of art. And those are really my interests.
Yeah. And what also makes it a work of art for me is that you can have stories that are very brief in terms of word count. I mean, your stories are never brief, even if the word count is small. And you can have a much longer piece, and yet each one tells a complete story, or at least tells the story until a good place to stop. Whereas so often the stories in collections today, one has a soap opera ending, so you think you're going to find out what's going on in the next. I like that every story in here stands on its own, and then when put together, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts in a way that doesn't often happen. When you set out to organize the book, were you conscious of those kinds of things, or did you just decide, this story is good, this story is good, I'm going to put them all in here?
No, this one was a bit different. I mean, they're all the same in terms of the objective, but the specifics and what they're going to be as works are different. This came about because there was a publisher, and I had this book called Musings with Franklin. It was this novel told in conversation, and I had Meatheads, which you know.
Yep.
And I had this other story collection called Cheer Pack,
which I have
stories from like from Glimmer Train and Harper's and places like that, big, very long, plotty stories. And this individual said, "No, I don't understand Meatheads. I don't understand Franklin." I'm thinking, like, well, how can you not understand things of that nature? And then just turn down Cheer Pack with no explanation. So I thought, right, screw this. So I went through like 25 years, which is how many, like it's a quarter of a century worth of fiction.
Right.
And I just sort of put it together as this punk, like, this person's just annoying the hell out of me. Like, this is just not someone who is, well, I won't even say what I was thinking. But I just sort of put it together defiantly. And then I did what I was going to do, where I start making something. And when I'm making something, I'm entirely present in that moment, however long or however many successions of moments there are. And then it's when it becomes this thing that you can't compare to any other thing. And you can't classify it. You can't, if you say, oh, check out this story collection, that all conjures an idea in our heads.
Right.
But that idea would be well afield of what this book is. So the stories are almost like chapters, but it's not a novel. Again, there are always these books, they end up, when they're by me, being their own thing. So I'm hyper-cognizant of what I'm doing. And I'm looking at, like, okay, well, the last page, the last story, the last chapter has a different role than the second story is going to have, and the first story is going to have. It's almost like a musician with an album. There's, like, you're going to put A Day in the Life last, and there's a reason for that. So it comes together in that sense where it's, I drive it together, but there is certainly like a master plan.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I was just going to make a musical analogy. I remember way back when my first band and I went out and did what you did in those days. You made yourself a vinyl LP and tried to hawk it. One of the guys in the rock stations in Hartford said to me, well, Bruce, this is either an amazingly versatile record or totally lacking in direction. And when I thought about that, driving home, I thought about the totally lacking in direction. I started to get angry because I thought, what's wrong with it being versatile? You know, why does it have to follow this guy's pattern? And that's what I find so remarkable about all of your books that contain what we call short stories or ficciones, is that you could jump in and say, I'm going to read the last story first. You could read the first story first. It doesn't make any difference. When you've read all the stories, your mind is sort of in a place where, I know what I do is I go back and I usually start reading them again a little more slowly than I did the first time, because I get so engaged the first time. When you look at the total output of short fiction in your life that you've created in the last 2 years, which is astonishing beyond belief, and it's not just that there's a lot of it, that it's all great. When you look at the future of your writing, how do you see those stories coming out to us? How are we going to get there? What are we going to do to make that happen?
I think I'm going to have to change the model, and things that you're aware of and people who read the blog are aware of are going to have to happen, where I'm in a different position where I'm dictating terms, mm-hmm. rather than being reliant on, or rather being prone to the discrimination that I can face right now. That's going to reverse.
Yes.
I'm going to have the leverage. And I don't know what the model is going to be. I don't know if it's going to be like subscription to a series of websites. I don't know how it's going to come out. But I know that my goal and what I think I'm here for is to get people reading again and to shift the paradigm of what it means to read. So in the meanwhile, what I do, and this is an act of faith, is I put the head down and I keep writing. So I'm closing in on 400 new stories since 4 years ago, June of 2018. That's plus all the Sam Cooke book and the Scrooge book. And I think three things came out over the weekend. I think there was like an op-ed and a feature, and these are in like million circulation places. But I don't even look up and notice that anymore, save to get paid when it's time. I just create, and I hope that it's going to work out later, because I don't think that I can just be here and be able to do what I do for it to come to nothing. And so when I'm writing all of these stories, they're individual creations, but I also have a plan for each of them as I'm going along. So there's the ghost story book. There is the Longer on the Inside book, which invents a new kind of literature. There are two volumes where all of the main characters are women. And certainly, I can't think of a male author who's ever done that. And so, like, things are earmarked as I'm going along. So I'm working, and I'm in the moment, and I'm completely focused on that work. But paradoxically, it's also like, with a vision, it's going to be part of this book, and it's going to play its role there. So it's like a lot going on at once.
Yeah, and, you know, I was thinking also as I was figuring out what I wanted to talk to you about today, one of my favorite quotes from my old friend Dave Van Ronk was, You can get a really good agent when you no longer need one. And what he was saying is that so often when the odds are stacked against what you're doing, you have to be your own guy. And that whole aspect of shameless self-promotion, unfortunately, doesn't work the way people think it's going to work, because every phony out there, and there are millions of them, and you and I have seen their work in 100 places, are doing just that. They're getting someone to say, this is the greatest story, you know, you should read this, blah, blah, blah. I think what you're doing is the way that it's going to change. I really believe that, that sort of just pounding out, and I don't mean pounding in the sense of plotting, but just creating this incredible, intense amount of art in a short period of time will eventually overwhelm the forces against you. And I, you know, if I can be part of the model, I'm going to be there, because I'm a big fan.
I think that's what it would have to be, because I'm sure you're aware of this. So-called writers, too. So it's just going to be me.
Yeah.
So-called writers write so infrequently. They really do. Like the other day, I wrote more last week than any of these people will in their lives. Quite literally in many cases. I remember one day last week, I knocked out two prefaces to two books, an essay collection and one of those all women storybooks. Well, they're men and too, but they're not sort of like the drivers of it. And that was over 4,000 words. And that was done by 11 in the morning. And so when you go to the websites of these people, they don't have sections like I do on my website where it's like, okay, here's the film, here's the op-eds, here's the sports. And it's woefully out of date, but there's still a ton up. But they will have a news section. Do you ever notice what's in their news section? It's never anything they've written or published. It's just people belating them. That's all it is. It's going to be some phony-ass award they won that they didn't deserve, that their dad got before them. There is no actual output. So then they get on Facebook, and they brag to each other about how for the first time in 4 months they wrote 600 words, and they can maybe use 47 of the words, and they'll polish them tomorrow. And 500 of them give the hosannas to that person. That is the kind of person is holding me back, because when they see what I do, what's going to make them feel awful about themselves? Then they're going to be like, wait, this is the guy who doesn't drink, who runs all the stairs too? And the animus is just going to go up and up and up, and then there I am. I mean, you can get up every day if you want at 4 a.m. and put the time in if you have the ability, but people aren't wired that way.
No, you're right. And it's funny you mentioned the longer on the inside and female narrators. The first two stories I had published in literary magazines when I started out both had female narrators. One was a 62-year-old woman skinny dipping during a heat wave in a creek in Maine, and the other was a young girl running on a winter night, a teenager. And they both got nominated for small literary magazine award prizes. They both came in second, and I met both judges later, and they said to me, oh, if I'd have known a guy wrote those, I would have given you the award. And I thought, it's going to be a long slog, Bruce. It's going to be a long slog. And you deal with this every day.
Yeah, well, think about when you read something, and it's like, at what point, usually it's the first line, are we going to find out that the protagonist went to Harvard and then went to a writing program? It's like, dude, it's you. It's obviously just you. You have such a dearth of imagination, and you just had this giant silver spoon in your mouth your entire life. You can't invent anything. You can't make us care. So when these things are hyped, then it's all about what's your skin color, what's your gender, are you the flavor of the month, are you mediocre? Because when you are mediocre, you are non-threatening to these people.
Exactly.
To a lot of people. And that is causing our culture, even though no one reads, that's causing our culture to devolve, because people, even if they don't read, they are around people who maybe get their ideas from somewhere else. There is a massive trickle-down effect. And I don't think you can understate the calamity that this industry of the worst people there have ever been is doing to our mental state, our society, and just where we stand culturally. So I'm in a war every day, to the point that for me to function, really all I can do right now, I mean, like hardly ever in the inbox, is create, publish, run the stairs, so I can keep creating to eventually prevail. But it's just a series of sinecures.
Yeah, sinecures is the word. We are talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Colin, one of the As you know, I'm a great admirer of your story, Jute, which is, I think, less than 700 words. And I was thinking how there's this great disconnect in America between people who say, I don't have time to read, and this burgeoning quote-unquote flash fiction or instant fiction genre, which really think exists. I mean, I think it's phony, and I'm pretty sure you agree the same way. When you look at the length of when you're planning a book, writing, whether you're thinking about a novel or you're thinking about it, what people would call a novel and stories, again, you and I would prefer to not look at it that way. When you're thinking about that, how hard is it for you to to kill your darlings, if it will, to say, I love this story, but it belongs better somewhere else?
I don't think it's particularly difficult because the volume is so outlandish at this point. And it's I don't want to say that I'm taking the long view, because as a friend of mine will say to me, he said, when this changes, this is going to change fast. Yeah. And you're going to have everything in place. You're going to have the body of work that no one can touch. And everything's going to matter. Every blog post, every segment on Downtown that's archived, because it's all there. And it contains things that people are going to consult, that are going to be radical, and that are going to affect change. So I don't really look at it like that. To be able to write something like Longer on the Inside, where most of the works are less than 1,000 words, I couldn't have done that 10 years ago. That was something that I had to get, I don't want to say good enough to do, because it's not like the work of 10 years ago was weaker, but I wasn't able to go in some of the directions that I'm able to go in now. So I think that's part of the thing, like with Brackets, because you have works in there that are from when I was in my early 20s, and I defy anyone to be able to identify them. But it was harder for me to do them, and it took longer, and it was more frustrating, and now it's not. So it's really not that difficult. And a lot of times, I don't look at this as something I have much of a say in, which sounds weird, but as we've talked about before, the characters, because they're real, I mean, they're not me, they're always going to give me the story, whether I wait them out, whether we hit it off, whatever it's going to be, they're going to dictate the direction. So it's not me imposing my will on anything. It's just being present and being open and knowing. I know this with a certainty more than I know that I'm alive and breathing oxygen. It's just how I am. It's who I am.
Yeah, and the other great thing about your stories, Colin, and the thing I don't see in literary magazines that I get for one reason or another, are stories where you know that the writer was on a journey of discovery. It's more, it always happens with your stories. I don't need to even feel like I know where they're going, right? Because I just know when I get there, you're going to have revealed to me what you discovered. They plot them out with an end in mind.
I don't even know that they plot them out. You know from the first few lines, like, exactly what you're in for. There are no surprises. You can just, like, okay, jump to the end, and there's, like you said, there's going to be that tacked-on kind of coda, which is just going to be exposition at the end. Like, oh, this is what this meant. 15 years later, it's like, yeah, okay. And that's, and then when they do these shorts and the so-called microfiction, there's an irony there, because they're only like Lydia Davis. They're like a few hundred words. Note how loaded it is with description for description's sake.
Right.
Because there's no story there. So then it becomes this poetical, oh, the tree waved in the breeze. And it's supposed to be some deep metaphor, but you know it's half-hearted, and you know they couldn't tell you what it... It's one thing, like, to have something open for interpretation. But in your mind, as the author, the creator, you have to know what the thing is. Maybe you don't tell anyone, but you have to know. You're working from a plan, and that will tell. That shows in the reaction that an agenda-free reader is going to have. These people are just trying to bluff and fake their way through everything because they're not working with anything.
Right, and so many of them that went to the programs, which you and I know about, thought they were going there to be discovered, that they already knew all they needed to know, and they would go there and someone would discover them. And then get resentful when that doesn't happen. So they, as you say, they form these alliances with people that can sort of shepherd along the phoniness and turn it into something that they can claim is real. It's like so much of the self-publishing industry, you know, that just drives me crazy.
That's the operative phrase that they can claim, that they can tell themselves. And then life or existence becomes this perpetual attempt to get yourself to believe something that you know is BS. I mean, that's the foundation of these lives. And then, of course, I come along. And I don't even need to say anything about the work. Someone reads Fitty. Someone reads Brackets. It's going to be what it is. People can try and say what they want to say, but that always reveals itself to be agenda-driven. Like, someone wants to say, oh, he does this bro thing. Yeah, I'm like the leading feminist writer. And, think over the weekend, there were like two big Judy Garland things, like million circulation places. Like, you're not going to get me because there's nothing to get me with, because it's all legit. And when they can't attack you, when there's not an opening, it becomes a freeze out. And so you mentioned agents. I mean, I would never go with an agent again. There isn't an agent in the country who would represent me. I'm the agent. I'm more successful than the agent's clients. Like, you don't think that they'd want them doing these things that I don't even like look to see that I've done? Someone just writes me at the website and they're like, oh, I saw this piece. It's like, oh, I guess that came out. That's good. Keep writing. Yeah. It's a completely different, it just shows you how fake it is. And so that's another thing that I'm dealing with right now, is that I'm dangerous to these people. I mean, I'm the exposer. I'm the legitimate case. And you can't be like, oh, maybe, you know, it's funny. I don't think we've ever spoken about this, but in all the years, no one has ever said to me, not once, it's never happened, you are not this thing that like you seem to think you are. I mean, they all know. No one's ever gotten drunk at night, had some pops, and just taken in a knot, and that's just never happened. No one has ever gone there.
Well, and no one should or could. And that's the other really interesting thing, is that, you know, you look at the websites of some of the people that we're familiar with, and not only is everybody pushing daisies up everybody's butt, but you never hear anybody even make the slightest comment about, oh, I wasn't really sure this worked or this messed up, because it's all about kissing up. And I don't know. It's crazy, but I got to tell you, Brackets is a really, really great book. And I'm going to call it a book, not a collection, because every one of these stories, from your kindness, I saw many of them before the book was all together, or before it was published, which was together long before that. I liked every single one of them. And, you know, as I've told you, that you're right up there with my favorite writers, Trevor and Joyce and Jack Driscoll and Joan Connor of short fiction. And I don't think there's anybody out there right now if you were a free agent, baby, every single major league team would be bidding on it, because you're bringing it better than anybody else I see anywhere.
It's funny, like when you, with these story collections too, it's like, do you remember the band Jerry and the Pacemakers?
Oh, certainly. I was a kid, and had a band. We played Ferry Cross the Mersey.
You'd have like Ferry Cross the Mersey, right?
Yeah.
And that's like your big hit. And then the record company would be like, we need a long player. And then you'd just go into the studio and you'd bang out like some covers.
Yep.
And that would be the filler. And so the whole album was like that, was that song, that hit. And you're just trying to move some more. You're trying to find a way to repackage the hit, the single, and sell it again.
Right.
That's what these story collections are. Maybe something came out, Cat Person. But Cat Person, that's sixth grade drivel. That's mediocre. And it caught on, and it had this hype. And so then they're like, okay, do the story collection, but we're not going to publish it for like 2.5 years. It's because she didn't even have the story.
Right.
She didn't even have the filler. Then she had, because you would have tried to capitalize on that in 6 months. So then she writes the filler. Have you ever, I don't even remember her name. Have you ever heard of her since?
No.
Gone. She is done. The career is over. And all of these people, and we joke, the flavor of the month, they're all some version of that. At best, if it works out for them in a utopian way, that's the best you can be with what they're working with. So, yeah, it's a war, but I have the faith, but I also have the confidence that I'm going to win.
I believe that too, Colin, and I wish you the best. And it's always a pleasure when I get to come in on a down on a Tuesday and talk to you. Rich will obviously be back next Tuesday. Thank you, my friend. And as always, I love seeing whatever you're sending me. And best of luck with everything.
All right, cool. Take care.
Thanks, Colin. Writer Colin Fleming, if you don't read his work, if you don't, especially his fiction, that's so important to me. I tell you what, you're missing out really on one of the best writers alive today. There's no question about that.